Invisible Girl by Maureen Marsh.
I'm invisible. I blend in. I'm part of the furniture. Most people want to be seen, to be important, to have likes on their social media. I do understand the battle against irrelevance. It's just that I've gone the other way and embraced mine. People frequently bump into me in shops, doorways, at work because, as I say, I'm invisible. I gave up on being seen a while ago. I can't remember when or why. It seems to me that the world is full of trouble, and that trouble starts with every human being I have ever met. My invisible life is a beautiful and manageable world. I live in a one-bedroom flat, which is tidy and sparse. My two cats, Prince Shiny Fur and Princess Snooty Pants, are much more visible than me with their naturally good looks. Princess Snooty Pants has so much fur that she looks like she was dipped in a candy floss machine, and the candy floss is a beige and yellow colour. Prince Shiny Fur is, as his name might suggest, they are trustworthy and amusing companions. Every day, I drive the short distance from my house to St. Jude's Hospital, where I change into my nurse's scrubs, avoid the gossip in the changing room, and start my day shift on Carlisle Ward at 6 a.m. Carlisle Ward is a geriatric ward. I know this is not to everyone's taste. Maybe it's seen as sad or depressing, but I find I have much in common with my patients. We have being invisible in common. And I find a humility in them, a gratitude that ordinary people seem to lack. Last year I held Audrey's hand as she breathed her last breath on this planet. It was a great privilege. Her frail, slender fingers wrapped around mine, her hands a map work of veins and blemishes. "You're a good girl," she whispered. "Thank you." She had no one, you see. No children, no husband, no relation. Everyone she loved died, and that's the curse of old age. We all want to live forever, but we miss that part. I like my job, and dare I say I'm good at it. I like everything about it. The smell of disinfectant and alcohol wipes, the long white corridors and the clippity-clop of efficient heels on freshly polished floors. And yes, it's probably not as well run as it might once have been, and yes, there's probably more admin and accounting for everything than I'd like, but I have the love and gratitude of my patients. Let me take you to the canteen. It is unimpressive and institutional. There is the smell of rancid fat everywhere. The walls are an avocado green and the tables match. You can hear the clinking sound of cheap cutlery and the murmurings of cheap talk. For an establishment that's about health and healthcare, the food is little to be desired. Chips and pizza, sausage and beans, stewed tea and instant coffee. It has not kept up with the times. You will not find any avocado and sourdough here, nor any skinny matcha latte. I'm looking around the assortment of health professionals and I spy the star of our hospital show. Dr. Richards really should be renamed Dr. Dreamboat. He has all the nurses like little fluttering butterflies around him. I watch him in the canteen as he systematically charms the pants off everyone. I hear him on the table next to me. "Hello, Nurse Deacon. Can I just say how excellent you were on noticing Mr. Watkins' meds were out? It's reassuring to have a nurse so observant." And he flashes her a wide smile, revealing white, gleaming teeth that shine out like a mystical light on the mundane canteen floor. It's embarrassing to see a 50-year-old woman who is plainly overweight and unattractive positively giggle at a compliment. She has her fork aloft with a large brown sausage, and something about this image tickles me, so I begin to laugh. Dr. Richard's soft brown eyes go a little darker as he meets my gaze. He looks confused for a moment, as though he's never seen me before, which, of course, he hasn't, because I'm invisible. And I stop laughing immediately, ploughing back into my jacket, spud and beans. But it's too late. I look up, and Dr. Richards is still looking at me, a quizzical look on his face. It is later that day when Dr. Richards catches me at the end of my shift. "You're new?" he says. "No, Dr. Richards," I keep my gaze down on the green linoleum floor. "I haven't seen you before, have I?" I don't respond. "How long have you worked here?" And he glances at my name badge, Marie Lewis. "3 years, Dr. Richards." He looks shocked. He says, "I thought I knew all the nurse practitioners in this ward." Just at this moment, Cheryl Hines, senior nurse, comes rushing over and pulls him away to discuss a patient, but I've spotted her pupils dilate and her cheeks flush. She is dripping with foolhardy passion. At 5 o'clock, my shift has ended and I change out of my uniform, and Charlotte, my colleague, looks over at me. "You look nice today. Have you done your hair?" as I head for the exit. She's never spoken to me before. I get home and barely have time to put my key in the lock when my phone buzzes. The word "mum" comes up and I'm debating whether I answer, and then I do. "Where have you been, love?" "At work, where do you think?" "Your father and I have left 6 messages. It's your birthday on Friday. You're 27. I had you at that age. This is a poorly veiled hint. "We want to visit you." "Please don't, mum." "What are you doing that's so important we can't visit? I know you won't be going out." She pauses and then adds, as if in hope, "What are you?" "No, it's just I have things to do." I'm inside the cottage now and fall into my favourite blue velvet armchair. Princess Snooty Pants takes this opportunity to spring onto my lap. She simply cannot resist a lap, her feather-dusted tail erect and dusting my nose, her engine purring at high octane. "When are you going to start to let people in, love?" "Please don't start, mum." "Just because it didn't work out with Justin doesn't mean I cut her off and switch the phone off. This is sacred ground and I won't have my silly 55-year-old mother remind me of my biggest and most foolhardy venture into visibility." Over the next few weeks, there is a buzz at work because Dr. Richards is leaving. He has an offer in America, apparently, and we're all going to combine the work's Christmas dinner and his leaving do at the Ashburnham Arms in town. I'm not planning to go. Well, I never go to these things. I watch everyone bustling about, talking in breathless exhilaration about what they are going to wear, take, do. A lot of the nurses are sad that the best eye candy at the hospital is leaving. I observe the commotion calmly at my desk and bite into an apple as I tap away. That's when I'm interrupted by a familiar voice. "Are you coming to the Christmas dinner, Nurse Lewis?" I look up at Dr. Dreamboat and mindlessly nod yes. The apple is stuck in my throat. "Are you meant to be eating on the ward?" he says with a sly smile. He then takes the apple out of my hands, looking at it, takes a bite, and then hands it back. "Very nice," he says, and then walks on. Somehow I have made the decision to go to the dinner, and I'm wearing makeup. I've not worn makeup in 5 years. It's like I'm wanting to be seen. I'm going to the dinner, and I've brought a dress. It's too tight, too red, too visible, but I'm wearing it. And as I walk in the restaurant, I see that faces are turning to look at me. I do not like it, and yet I do. The waiter spots me and takes me to the table. Everyone there has clearly already got started on the wine and spirits. There is tinsel and lights decorating the space, and Christmas carols are belting out of the sound system. I spy Dr. Richards laughing with a gaggle of female health professionals, and their mistletoe is aloft. He politely kisses the assorted cheeks of drunken, lascivious female health professionals. I take a glass of wine and drink it in seconds. My mouth is too dry, my appetite non-existent, as I observe the next 2 hours of food and drink, small talk and noise. Then, standing up, I go to the ladies, thinking, maybe it's time to make my escape. But as I come out, I bump into Mr. Dreamboat himself, and he holds a small sprig of mistletoe up. "Happy Christmas," he says. He's drunk. I can smell whiskey on his breath. He moves close to my face. I feel his breath tickle my cheek. And then, stopping suddenly, he says, "You don't like me, do you?" And turns to go back to the table. The party is coming to an end. People are leaving and taxis are arriving. "Good luck, Richard. We'll miss you." He's leaving. He's staggering out into the cold, damp air. I watch him move towards the taxi. And then, as if propelled by something else, not me, I run. I run out and up to him. I hold my mistletoe up and I say, "I do like you." I say it breathlessly and I kiss him. A long enough, big enough, huge enough kiss to remember. And the kiss wakes me up from a long enchanted sleep and a spell is broken. The next few weeks are strange and awkward. I am relearning a new dance with life, one that includes other humans. I've been invited to a baby shower. I've been asked out by Terry, the radiologist. I am no longer invisible. I've rejoined the complicated, difficult, ugly, strange, beautiful, exhilarating world of humans again. Wish me luck.